Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, this is Bruce Norris. Thank you for joining us. Today we're joined by Michael Pines. Michael has been a California licensed attorney since 1977. He's been a real estate broker since 2005, and he's the founder of RE Ventures, who bought about 50 properties or so in Utah and continues to do so in California, and was involved with the RTC in the 1990s. So, Michael, we welcome you, and perfect timing.
Well, thanks, Bruce.
What was your involvement in the 90s at the RTC?
Well, how I first got involved is I represented a client who had a large parcel of land that he tried to subdivide to do manufactured housing on. I think there were maybe 100 or 200 lots. So I don't know. Some people might consider that large, some not. Mm-hmm. And he got into a dispute with the owner and into a legal dispute. And the owner subsequently lost the property in the real estate collapse. The property was taken over by the RTC, so the RTC inherited the litigation.
I see.
And there was a law firm in San Diego who was representing the RTC on their San Diego cases, and so they took over the case for the – and they represented the RTC.
Okay. This guy was just doing subdivision work, sort of had an option on it, that type of thing?
He's an interesting guy. He was actually owned a liquor store, and then as a hobby, he always loved real estate and started subdividing it. And
okay.
He would buy, you know, one lot. He started with one lot and subdivided it into two and realized that, it increased the value and worked his way up to the point where he would mostly buy land and subdivide it. And he bought this land. He could get greatly increased density by doing manufactured housing because there was a demand for it in this particular city down near San Diego. And so he was pushing that through. There was seller financing. There was subordination. There was a dispute over the subordination.
It sounds like a big mess.
It was a big mess. There were easements, So
now, is that typical of the properties that end up going back to an RTC? Were they in the middle of development, or were they usually foreclosed on by the lender themselves, or is it a mixture of both?
My experience was that it was a mixture of both. And I, of course, didn't get involved with all the inventory
right.
The RTC had, but they had a lot of property. Not as much as we're going to have this time, but they had a lot of property. And so but it was a mixture.
Okay. Now, the type of property for the S&L crisis, was that inherently different because of what caused the S&L crisis as opposed to what's causing this? In other words, the tax law change, for instance, in 86, was there a lot of apartments and commercial stuff that the RTC had to deal with?
Things are always the same and they're always different. I am just absolutely amazed at the similarities between what happened, what the causes of the S&L crisis,
okay.
The way it came about, the reasons for it, how it evolved, and the crisis that we're having today. It's almost like I'm reliving it. And if you go to, Wikipedia or whatever one of those online encyclopedias is, mm-hmm. And I'm just assuming that if you Google the savings and loan crisis or the RTC and you start reading about it, I think people will be shocked at the similarities. I mean, it basically started because the savings and loans got themselves in trouble financially,
mm-hmm.
And then they deregulated them, and then they started making very foolish real estate investments and loans, riskier and riskier. The greed kicked in, and there are many, many other similarities, but it's just history repeats itself. It really does.
And here we are again.
Now,
deregulation back then, didn't we learn? I mean, that's interesting when you do repeat something. It's been 20 years since that problem started. And that's what's interesting. The RTC really didn't show up until 89, but it showed up because the FSLIC went broke.
Right.
After many hundreds of lenders already went belly up.
Right. Kind of sounds like Fannie and Freddie.
Exactly.
I mean, that's why I say the parallels. I'm sorry, but the parallels are amazing. But I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. No, it's just I've also just looked at, you know, me and charts, and I looked at charts over the time period where this RTC existed, about 89 to mid-95. The stock market went crazy, went up almost 300%.
Right.
And real estate, we had a tough time. That's just very interesting to me that those two worlds went so differently. Was it because the financing for real estate wasn't available, or there was just too many REOs dictating the price of the inventory?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, we had a stock market explode, and we had the real estate market tank from 90 to 95 in California. So you have two very different responses to where you would think, okay, all of the investments are going to be bad. It wasn't true.
It's because the stock market was not nearly as tied to real estate as it is now.
Okay.
There was securitization involved in those loans even back then, but it was completely different arrangement. And the two things were very different. The stock market was very different back then and very separate from the real estate market, whereas this time it's so intertwined that it's impossible to separate.
This time we have not just ourselves involved, but we have a lot of foreign countries involved. Was that true last time, or is this unique this time?
It's unique this time.
Okay. And securitization, that was much more practiced this time around, I would think.
Yes. It was much more limited, and it was different. It was packaged differently. It was only similar because a lot of the mortgage packages were securitized back then, but they were securitized completely differently. It's just interesting the parallel that Wall Street was involved, but much more peripherally, not directly. This time it's much more direct.
When the RTC started, we thought there was going to be approximately a $30 billion to $50 billion problem. Kind of grew outside of that in about 3 months and then took off from there. Is that common with estimates from the government? And do you think that's going to be a replay, only we starting with $700 billion this time?
Absolutely. And my opinion is it's going to be trillions. I mean, I think that the $700 billion barely scratches the surface. I think that politically, they're already having trouble asking for money, and there's so much political sentiment against what people think is a bailout. I personally don't. That I think they went in asking for I think they know this is a drop in the bucket. This is going to be a multi-trillion dollar problem, in my opinion. And it's very typical. I mean, you always hear about the government getting involved in something. I mean, just, you know, building a plane or something, and they think it's going to be this much, and then it doubles and doubles and doubles again.
Right.
Well, in this kind of a situation, in my experience, it's even worse. And so it's just that they can't politically possibly – they can't even get to first base on this legislation. If they went in and were honest with people and, you know, really told them that it was going to be trillions of dollars, you can imagine the political fallout from that.
What was the sentiment during the RTC's origination to where they say, okay, we need this? The public sentiment probably was very similar, and yet the long-term ramifications, if we thought they were going to be dire, didn't really pan out that way.
Actually, it wasn't. People just weren't as politically aware or something, or that this was not an issue. It was not nearly as big of an issue.
Okay.
People did definitely see it as a bailout. I don't think there was as much skepticism or animosity towards the government as there is now. I mean, people were certainly skeptical.
Okay.
I just think they were either a little more trusting, but it wasn't nearly as difficult for them to get that whole thing set up politically as it is now.
I read in Fortune magazine one of the spokespersons for the Congress was asked, you know, where did that $700 billion number come from? And is that based on anything that's real? And she said something to the effect that, no, we just really needed to pick a very large number. Maybe that was a little bit too honest.
Yep.
But yeah, there's probably multiples that's attached to what's coming up. But I wonder, now you said you don't consider it a bailout. So why don't we talk about what it is, the plan? And I've read the entire document. I read 110 pages of that wonderful stuff 2 nights ago. So I'm familiar with it a little bit. And maybe we can start with this. Do you think much of it trickles down to the individual guy that owns something who might be in foreclosure?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. I didn't get that sense, but it probably is because it fixes some bigger problem over here.
Right.
So what when you say you don't think it's a bailout, tell us what you get a sense of what they're trying to do. They're trying to buy these assets, I think, but...
Right. Well, first of all, the reason I don't think it's a bailout is because the people who made money already got it and they're gone, and they're not very likely to give it back.
Okay.
Now, there will be people that will go to jail.
Yes.
There will be people that will have to give the money back. But the sense I get from the press is that they're going in and the same people who created this are going to profit from it. And I don't think that's really true. Those people already made their money, they took the money, they're gone with it, and this probably isn't going to help them. And in fact, I think anybody that acted dishonestly, not anybody, there's too many people,
mm-hmm.
but the major players who acted dishonestly, the government will make an effort, the SEC, the FBI will make an effort to go after those people and at least try to track some of them down, if for no other reason, I hate to sound skeptical, but to make an example. I mean, they can't possibly track down everybody that is at fault in this because there's a lot of fault to go around. There are a lot of people that did things that are technically illegal, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But they will go after at least some of the big players, and those people will have to give money back, will go to jail, and they certainly won't be involved in trying to fix this problem. So that's the first reason I think this really isn't – we're not really saving them in any way. This money that's coming now is designed to try to fix the problem for the people who weren't at fault.
Okay. Now, this $700 billion is going to buy some kind of asset or securitization. I'm not sure what it's buying, and I read the document. And I think a lot of it is, okay, within 60 days, we have to be specific. I got a lot of that when I read the document.
What I believe they will do, and first of all, nobody knows. And
okay.
That was one of the big objections of Congress is we're basically giving you guys too much power. We're giving you a blank check. And frankly, Congress has to do that because they're not the experts. You know, the experts are saying kind of turn it over to us because if we have to show you how to do this. I mean, how can you teach somebody how to be a lawyer or an economist,
right.
You know.
In a couple of days. Yeah,
in a couple days and educate them. It doesn't work. And so it's not clear. And frankly, I don't think they know what they're going to do yet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what they're going to do is examine these institutions and try to figure out how to get off of their books what they need to get off of their books by either buying or guaranteeing or whatever programs. Those are at least two things they're going to do that were specified in that law. But I'm sure they'll come up with other things. And I don't think they know yet. They just know that they need money and they need the ability to go to these institutions and help them. And I'm not sure they even know exactly how they're going to help them yet.
Okay.
But they want the authority to buy, you know, just go in and buy it and take it over so the institution can survive, hopefully.
One of the things the document did say is that if there were restatements of earnings for any of the lenders where there were big golden parachutes, that those guys would be giving up their bonuses.
Right, and they'll have to give back any unearned bonuses.
Right, that's a few bucks.
That's a lot.
Yeah, so that'll solve half the problem right there.
Well, it won't solve half the problem, and I don't know that those guys are going to give it back without a fight. I expect the litigation over that to be extremely interesting. Because I don't see these guys on Wall Street just writing them a check. But that's what, again, to the point of it's not really a bailout because those people are, you know, if the government comes in and says, we're going to help this institution, if you're still there, or even if you're gone and you took some money, then we're going to try to get it back, which will be the job of different agencies. But
okay. Let's talk about the RTC and see if we can connect what's likely to come out now. So let's say that there's money provided and there's assets purchased by a failed lender, whether it be mortgages or it be actual REO inventory. How did they go about appraising what they had? And were there offices everywhere that there were properties, or that was they, were they trying to do this from a central location?
It changed. The first 2 years was an absolute fiasco. The government tried to do it itself. It didn't do a lot of joint venturing or partnering or contracting out of services. And they weren't equipped to do it. And so, for example, I do recall the first couple of years, their office for disposing of California real estate was in Dallas,
okay,
physically located in Dallas. I don't remember exactly how long that was. But, you know, they were so frantic just trying to get set up and get things organized, and they didn't have an office in California. They did hire attorneys in California to help them with the legal matters, but they had nobody. So when I was negotiating with somebody, they had to fly people out from Dallas, and most of the time these people didn't know California real estate, didn't understand it, didn't even know where the property was. So that's the way it started. And the first 2 years, the RTC was taken advantage of so badly by people that were buying from them, and they took such a bath, they started changing it. And then over the next 4 or 5 years, we went through 4 or 5 sequences of different arrangements where they brought in partners, basically, and had different kind of arrangements who were better equipped to deal with disposing of debt or distressed real estate.
As they went longer into the 90s, the market got worse.
Yes.
So that was working against them. The values probably descended, and the desirability of those things probably went down as far as who could buy them.
Right.
So their timing on that one, that was kind of tough. What kind of quantity are we talking about when the RTC dealt with properties? Any dollar amounts or, you know?
They started out being willing to sell property in very small quantities. You know, maybe even, you know, they weren't equipped to do it one at a time is the problem. So they almost couldn't do that.
Okay.
But they wanted to. And then as time went by, they started packaging. I think they got advice from people that were more knowledgeable about how to dispose of real estate. And they started packaging them in, you know, bigger and bigger quantities. However, for example, that case I mentioned to you I got involved in, they had separate properties that they had to deal with separately because they were unique in some way. Mm-hmm. In this case, there was litigation. And they couldn't do anything with this property. So I actually went and found a buyer for them for this property. And so, you know, it just depended. But as the years went along, they wanted to package them in bigger and bigger packages, and ultimately ended up saying they would only sell property in packages or sell debt in packages.
Okay. They sold debt as well then?
They did.
Okay. Because I can see.
Sale isn't sometimes exactly, that's why I hesitated the right word, but they did arrange for sales transactions of debt.
Okay. How were they typically, the properties typically marketed, even if they were in bulk? Was there an auction, or was there a list? How did that work?
It changed a lot. They kept trying different things. And they auctioned it. When they started doing it in bulk, they tried not to have everybody in the world come to see them and tried to direct their efforts towards the players who were big enough to really buy in bulk. And so there were a lot of different things they did over that, you know, 6 or 7 year period, and it kept changing. And things changed drastically every year because the structures and the arrangements they had changed every year.
Was there changes just because political parties changed? I mean, I don't, you know, just trying to think if that had anything to do with that.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
It wasn't politics. They just kept struggling to figure out the best way to do this. And, you know, it might have had something to do with change in political parties because different experts would come in, different advisors give them different advice. But that didn't appear – that wasn't obvious. Mm-hmm. What was obvious is they kept trying different things to make it better and better, different kinds. And the arrangements got fairly complex over time.
Do you think that they that's not too far in the distance. That's 20 years ago. Do you think they're going to put together a team of people that had experience there and say, okay, we don't have to get out of the gate so poorly this time? Or do you think they're going to get overwhelmed like by the quantity just – because it's so much bigger this time?
Both. They're already soliciting people who were involved. For example, I spoke to somebody today. He's a lawyer with 40 years banking experience. Mm-hmm. And they have already, and he was involved with the RTC. They've already brought him back. And they're looking for other people. So hopefully those individuals learned from having dealt with the RTC. And they're looking for those people. But, of course, a lot of them now are retired or whatever. So,
The FDIC is doing the same thing for all the banks they expect to fail. I think a lot of people think because you put together this bailout, then the problem is over, and it's nothing of the kind. The RTC was established, and most of the lenders that failed happened after they were established.
Right.
And the RTC ended up being the solution for all of that, but it was an awful lot for a long time.
Right, and they just kept dumping. As an institution would fail, then the RTC would get more and more, inherit more and more debt or real estate that it had to dispose of.
And the staffing got very large. It started out with something around, this is the FDIC, started out with 3,000 people. By the time they were done, they were over 10,000, and that was dealing with this big quantity of mess they had. Do you think the best deals were had early in the process? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Do you see – what chances do you see for investors this cycle? Because this may take a while. Let me ask you how long you think it's going to be going through the inventory, and what do you think the – where do you think the deals are going to be for investors?
I think it's going to take a very long time. I hate to come up with a specific number. We're not talking months. We're talking years.
Okay.
And the RTC, the savings and loan crisis, was tiny compared to this. And that took, what, 6-7 years, something like that?
Yep.
So on the other hand, that was before the days of the technology we have now, which helps make things go faster. Things seem to happen just faster in general these days.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are going to be, and already are, enormous opportunities because – as I've learned from Bruce Norris, I used to study this myself, real estate goes in cycles. So hopefully we won't go into a Great Depression. California will come back, and the people who can buy real estate now and know what they're doing can manage it and hold it until the next upcycle, or can even just help solve this problem by buying now, repairing things, getting things in condition, and getting homeowners back in them. I think there's opportunities for both of those right now, and I think they are tremendous opportunities.
It sounds like you think that ultimately the bulk buyer will actually have something worthy of looking at, because so far they haven't, but this could create a pile of very good properties with a seller that only wants to really off them in that type of quantity.
Right.
Okay.
I think there will be enormous opportunities way beyond even what we saw. I mean, my clients, because I also represented some buyers. As I said, I found a seller. I found a buyer for the one specific property that I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
They did extremely well in the long run and made a ton of money. And it's already going on now. They were mostly, you know, what we would call today venture capital funds, private equity groups. And they would get people together and then go buy these properties in bulk. And most of them did extremely well.
I would think we're being able to look at packages, I think, in the next few years way below replacement costs. So it's going to create opportunity if you think California is going to survive, and I think they will. Michael, we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
Okay, and you'll be back next week to talk about the foreclosure changes in the laws.
Thanks, Bruce.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.